I'll give you two words that can really raise the blood pressure of a lot of people. Acquisition reform. I have so many friends and colleagues that talk to me about, hey, we've had dozens of reports over the past several decades and not a lot gets done. But what are some tangible steps that we could do now to actually acquire the things that the warfighter or that intel operator needs to get in the fight and to stay ahead of the fight? Our next guest, attorney Mark Snyderman, he's got some answers and he's not in the clouds. He's got pragmatic answers based on years of experience as a GovCon vet. He was a chief operating officer of a major company, helped their growth explode by several 100%. He's also been general counsel within a GovCon firm. But beyond that, this guy innovates and he's all about thinking of rubber meets the road. How can I come up with tactical ideas and applications that work?
GovCon different. Ideas from the outside applied to GovCon to drive change.
Mark, it is great to talk with you again.
Oh, great to talk to you too.
So you're an attorney and you're also involved in multiple businesses today.
Yeah.
So you've got this entrepreneurial side of you, but you spent years in GovCon trying to pursue big contracts, whether it was Army, different customers. Now, when we talk about acquisition, most every day, whether virtually or in person in a boardroom, I'm with people and they're complaining about the acquisition process. Because I do so much work in coaching people, orals coaching, and they're complaining, well, the RFP's not even understandable, and this drives me crazy, and I just wish we could be more innovative. From your perspective, when we talk about the procurement process, what's really wrong? I mean, how do we, you know, how do we boil it down? Because people, they complain about the FAR, the Federal Acquisition Regulations.
Yeah.
There's so much frustration. But from your point of view, when you put on your GovCon and your lawyer hat, you've got these very unique experiences and the commercial side. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with the system?
I mean, I think the probably the biggest problem is that we get so wrapped up in the regulatory piece of it and trying to create what quote unquote a level playing field that it just bogs the whole system down. And they need to be a bit more business oriented. And if you go back in history, you know, when we grew our company, it was, you know, the Bush years.
Right.
And the Bush years were known as the business, you know, he was the only MBA president, quote unquote. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you really felt it when there was work going on in the GovCon world, things could get done.
Mm-hmm.
Clients had money, clients had needs, clients could get you money, could get funding on contracts and make things happen.
Right.
The acquisition cycle has reverted completely back to the pre-Bush years, like the olden times in the last, you know, three, four years.
Mm-hmm.
And we're in like these, you know, super long acquisition cycles. Clients can't get money on contract. You know, it's really just difficult. And I would say, you know, probably the biggest problem for most companies is that small businesses are getting crushed in GovCon.
Mm-hmm.
All over again, despite how many times we say we're going to do all these great things for small business and there's all these set asides and all these things. When you look at it from my perspective, when I go to 10,000, 30,000 feet up and I say, well, what are you really doing here? You're creating almost all the contracts you see now are multiple award IDIQ, right? Trying to limit the competition, trying to limit protests, right? So lawyers are a big problem, right? I always say that. I'll say it all the time. Lawyers create a lot of issues in this world because of how litigious, and they'll push things that really shouldn't be pushed. And you have all these protests that go on. So the government gets afraid that anything they do is going to get protested.
Right.
So what do? Well, just award it to five different companies, you know, to all five bidders, right?
Yeah. So a couple things. You said a lot of things that are interesting there. I want to step back with the Bush years, kind of things were rolling and then they changed. So what drove some of that in your view? What was administration's change, of course, but what kind of drove us backwards in your view? What was the thinking or the intent that kind of got us here?
Well, I think the intent was that, you know, things got so quick and fast, it almost became like commercial business in some ways, right? So then you have the fear that, are we really being fair? Are we really giving a level playing field? Are we giving everybody opportunity? because you're probably not. Mm-hmm. It's always a balance that they have to come up with, you know, to try to figure out where acquisition should be reformed. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you know, it's never a perfect world, but we're far from a perfect world when, you know, I use a good example these days of like these GSA vehicles that are coming out, right?
Right.
All these massive, you know, contracts. And if you're not on them and you're not getting a seat on them, you're probably going to lose a whole lot of opportunity for business, mm-hmm. right? As a prime.
Right.
You're going to be a sub for the rest of your career, for the rest of your life, which, you know, not always the worst thing, but it's not always the best thing. Depends on what your future holds.
Right. So let's say people are out there listening. They say, okay, oh, I get it. There's bureaucracy, maybe too many lawyers, but why does that really matter? I mean, okay, so what? A lot of paperwork. You have companies doing business with the government. Mm-hmm. But from when we talk about mission and national security and from the good of the country, from your point of view, why are some of these challenges really a problem?
Well, because small businesses is where innovation really occurs, mm-hmm. right? Small businesses are the heartland of this country, or the heartbeat of the country. Mm-hmm. They will always be the most innovative because they can be. You know, big businesses have, you know, I mean, they're public, some of the tier ones that are public companies, you know, they can only do so many things, right? They're only allowed to spend money on so many things. No matter how innovative they want to be, they can. Mm-hmm. So they need to go to small business and be able to pull tech from small business and pull it into the real world. Mm-hmm. Tech transfer is a push pull, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you can either push it or you can pull it, right? So you're getting a pull from the government or a pull from the tier ones and the tier twos, or you're going to push it up, right? Mm-hmm. And right now, it's a lot of, you're going to have to get a lot of pull because you can't push it because you have no contractual vehicle. You have no way to do it. You have a lot of, I mean, there are certainly agencies that are trying hard to be more aggressive mm-hmm. and find technology in the way they need to. Like, you know, the Air Force has AFWERX. Mm-hmm. You know, there are ways that they're trying to do it. I mean, they've tried to engage Silicon Valley to try to get some of the best tech that's out there. Mm-hmm. But you still look at the way most of the government runs, it's antiquated.
Right. And if we look at that, and then we think about China and whether it's hypersonics, whether it's artificial intelligence, these things really matter, right? I mean, when you talk about this could be one of the biggest bottlenecks to really unleashing innovation.
Yeah.
And I want to go back to, so you mentioned it's difficult for smalls. What's an example? People hear, oh, okay, it's difficult for smalls, but what's an example, Mark, from your way of thinking or your experience of where you just observe small businesses struggling to engage with the process?
I mean, there's so many, but, you know, I'll use one of the small businesses that I represent as a good example of the process being broken. And this isn't necessarily just engaging in the acquisition, getting into doing an acquisition. This is a company trying to get its 8A status, right? Mm-hmm. And it's important because we have programs out there to try to support small business and support small disadvantaged business. But then we have all these crazy regulations around it that make it really hard for them to get in. So you're really, and when you hear the story, it kind of tells why you would have a lot of minority owned businesses that may say, I'm not going through that. That's insane. Why would I want to do that? Hmm. And so this was a gentleman that was an Army Ranger, just a phenomenal individual, wicked smart, dual master's degrees, worked for a big company in one of the three-letter agencies as a contractor, mm-hmm. you know, clearances out the wazoo, decides he wants to start his own firm, starts his own company, builds up on his own a couple $1 million worth of business with no status.
That's awesome.
I mean, just because he's really that good and that smart.
Yeah.
And, you know, understands what the government needs and how to fill and how to get the right people in place. You know, he's really good. So, well, the problem is that the 8A program says that in order to apply, you have to show profitability in your company for 2 years straight, mm-hmm. which is totally flipped upside down in my view, right? We're trying to help a small disadvantaged business. We're setting a program up for them, yet we're telling them until you're profitable for 2 years, we're not going to help you.
Right. And why?
Which is just crazy.
Why do they ask that? I mean, why is 2 years of profitability the threshold to get in?
I think that they're looking to make sure that the businesses are going to be sustainable, right? Okay. And that if they go out and they get sole source work, they're going to be able to perform, mm-hmm. right? That they'll have the financial wherewithal to do it,
right?
I think that's the thought process.
Right. Now, but this guy, who he sounds amazing, and I have a special place in my heart for entrepreneurs. I and my partners, we are, and I understand what it's all like, and it's not all glamorous, right? A lot of it is you pick yourself out of the ditch on a daily basis.
Oh, yeah. On a daily basis.
But he had been profitable, but not for 2 years continuously. What happened was
he was doing a lot of classified type work. Mm-hmm. And if you know one of the big holes in our system is getting clearances through.
Oh God.
Right. Yeah. They take forever these days, and especially if you need full scope kind of clearances for, you know, three-letter agency work, that stuff's really hard to get.
Yes.
And you're hiring really high-priced people that you can't get cleared, but you can't lose the opportunity to have that person be the person that's going to be in that seat because you need to fill that seat. Mm-hmm. So you take on, you know, some bad financing, right? Which is what happened.
I see.
You know, and he ended up in a bad financing deal. You know, I could say that, you know, it was, you know, it's everything, you know, when I looked at it, when I walked in and found what the deal was, I'm looking at it like, this is insane. I can't believe that this is the deal you got. It's terrible. Mm-hmm. And as he said, it was the only thing that was available to him.
Right.
You know, now it was the only thing available to him because he was minority, because he was a veteran. It's hard to tell. Right. But all those things seem to stack up in a way that it makes it look that way. So I'm thinking, you know, well, we should be able to argue that, you know, the only reason you're not profitable is because of this deal. You know, we should be able to get you through.
Right.
And, you know, it took 6 months of arguing with the SBA to get them to grant it. And we had to show like a real path forward as to how we were going to fix profitability and everything else.
And that's a small business.
Small
business association for our listeners. Yeah.
So, you know, and when you hear those kind of stories and you look at him on paper and you say, you know, that's how many hoops you have to jump through to get status. Now, I'm not saying there shouldn't be a lot of hoops, right?
Right.
Because you can't just have anybody and anybody coming along to get, you know, preferred status in contracting. We have to know who they are. But, you know, if he's not the example of what we're supposed to be supporting, I'm not sure what is.
Right. Now, ultimately, Mark, did you get him there? Were you able to succeed?
Yeah, he did get there. Yeah. Yeah.
But an incredible, let's be honest, he had to pay all kinds of anxiety, frustration.
Oh, yeah.
How did he do once he got in?
He's doing good. He's doing okay. Yeah, he's doing well.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's hard, right? You know, everything's the GovCon business is hard, right? Mm-hmm. You know, despite the, you know, especially, you know, 8A, and people think the 8A means that, you know, money bags are getting dropped off at their door, but it's not really how it happens. I mean, you know, it is still a long process. You know, if you do know a customer that understands the rules and has, you know, the wherewithal to push, that's great. I mean, another problem with the acquisition system right now is the age of the acquisition workforce, right? Mm-hmm. We had a huge age out of, you know, contracting officers, right? They're all gone. Mm-hmm. And you have a lot of young people, you know, they say they're green, right? There's a lot of green contracting officers and COTARs and CORs that, you know, think that everything is, that they only understand the book.
Right.
You know, and nobody's saying we should play outside the book, but there are ways within the book to play it that it's not necessarily only, there's not only one way to play a game, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes you need to play the game in another way. And because you get they haven't been taught and they haven't been mentored properly, mm-hmm. they don't know what they don't know. And they only know X. So if X isn't the answer, it can't be done.
Yeah. And then that makes it, again, much harder for that Army Ranger that we just talked about that goes into business. And I have a special place in my heart for that because you can be a brilliant entrepreneur, but that doesn't mean that you know the FAR, that you know how you really work the system to get money on contract, right. That you know the legal sides of it. There are so many aspects of it and trying to pull all of that together. And I want to just dig into for a second. You mentioned that a lot of times in GovCon, you have to be prepared for the lead times and be more strategic. So, and we've got listeners that are in GovCon, but we have listeners that are not. What does that mean, Mark, that if a small business got a great idea, you're going to show up and, ooh, they're just going to buy it tomorrow, right? Or not? Kind of explain to the listeners what you mean by those lead times.
Yeah, it doesn't happen. Like, you know, I mean, if you have a piece of, let's say you invented the greatest, you know, piece of software that the government absolutely needs, right? You know, there's a need, you develop something. I could just go in and I'm just going to sell it to them, right? Not realizing that it doesn't work that way. Like your ability to get a sole source kind of vehicle, even if you could get sole source, right? You're an 8A and you can do it non-competitively. Even that's a 6-month lead time at best.
Right. And sole source, for those that, again, are not acquisition nerds like you and I are, sole source is, I don't have to compete this. I have something so unique that the government just puts a contract in place with me. And even that is six months.
Yeah, probably more.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah.
So let's say they say, oh, it's something that they had, you know, they already have a system. They're going to replace that system. They're going to have to compete it, right? So if it's going to go to competitive, you're going to see a request for information because they got to put it out to the world to say, are there two small businesses out there that could do this? Because if there is, then we might have to look at a set aside for a small business. If not, we're going to go full and open.
Yes.
We're going to put this out to the world. And somebody's going to say something. They're going to it'll get delayed. You'll watch these things track for 12, 18, 24 months before you actually see that thing come out.
Yeah.
You know, so if you're banking on the government being your first customer for whatever you're building, it's a tough road.
I'll say it is. So, yeah. And you may only have 6 months of money to stay alive, right, in that business.
Yeah. So usually what I tell, like, so, you know, I'm involved with a lot of startups, and a lot of them come to me knowing that, you know, I have GovCon experience. You think this is something the government would need? I say, absolutely. Absolutely. Great piece of technology. Totally something the government could use. Mm-hmm. They're not our primary customer. I said, what do you mean? Don't they have more? Isn't the U.S., isn't the Department of Defense the largest procurer of goods and services in the world? Yes, they are. They're not going to be ours until we get some money in.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not just raising money. It's raising money and get commercial customers, and then we'll go to the government. Mm-hmm. Unless we can get ourselves into an SBIR or some program where we can get some funding in to help move the technology along. And that's really the only place that you can access that the government, and it's not an SBIR phase one, because a phase one is $75,000 or $100,000. It's not doing anybody too much good. You have to get to the phase twos and threes.
Yeah, and for those, Mark, the SBIRs, what does that acronym stand for?
So it's Small Business Innovative Research Programs. Yeah. And you know, every agency has SBIR dollars. Mm-hmm. They're great. There's, you know, you can look up and see what topics the government is interested in, and where they're looking to spend money, and where research, they're looking for applied research and new tech. Mm-hmm. And it is probably the best way for most small businesses to engage in trying to bring tech. The only other way, really the other way you look at it, is either getting pulled by a tier one or tier two, right? Mm-hmm. You have a tech that you can prove out and you can get Lockheed or Raytheon to say, yeah, I need that. And I'll get you into the system. Mm-hmm. You know, the other way is kind of OTA, which is other transaction authority, which for a lot, you know, so just to explain that. So NASA started other transaction authority because of their need for super tech that nobody was coming up with and they couldn't find anywhere. And they said, hey, maybe if we don't have to contract through the FAR and we can do something on our own, maybe we can get some of these small innovative companies to come bring us some tech. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's kind of where it started, right, in the Space Act. And then it's flowed its way into every agency, into all the other agencies, right? So most of the Defense Department, almost all the Defense Department has their own OTAs that exist.
Right, yet a lot of small businesses, and I mean, out of the garage, they don't know about it. Or again, they may not know how to navigate those circles. So as I listen, go ahead, Mark, please.
And they're supposed to make it, and you know, and it's just like everything else, right? In the government contracting world, in the acquisition world, it was supposed to be non-FAR based and not as rigid, and an ability to get things done quickly. Mm-hmm. And each year, you watch the OTA vehicles become more and more like a FAR acquisition.
Oh, wow. Yeah, the bureaucracy like, just encroaches.
They're just crushing onto it. And part of it is, you know, the contractors, right? And I'm one of them, right? We will push any angle we can get where we can find something that you can actually push it to say, well, if I push the limits of, you know, if I push it, I can get more money through this because it's easier. Mm-hmm. And the customer's happy because, you know, there's always this big, like who's really the customer, right?
Yeah.
Is it the contracts people or is it your customer that's got the money that wants the work done? Mm-hmm. Well, for most, for all of the GovCons, we think it's it's the client, right? It's the end user, yes, right, that we're doing the work for. Well, contracts doesn't really always think that way. Mm-hmm. Some of the contracts department think that that's their job, right? They're the customer.
And back to what you said, this notion of a level playing field, though, sounds good, but it pops up. People say, yeah, OTAs, but then people say, people are working around the system, so we need to clamp down on that a little bit.
Yeah.
And I get the notion of an open playing field, fair and open competition, of how important that is, but there are some of these unintended consequences. Now, I want to throw out a little bit of a scenario for you. As we're talking, it really hits me that if your great firm in Silicon Valley or across the US, and this is what we are known for in the United States, I mean, we are an innovation engine. Entrepreneurialism, yeah, I get we got our problems, but our track record, our productivity is just unprecedented. But if you and I, let's say you and I and a few other folks, we decide that we've got a great idea and it's regarding quantum computing and we're working with some scientists and it's off the charts and we know it's good. But just as you've said, whether a guy comes to me and says, hey, I've got great software, let's go to the Pentagon, and you're going, nah, let's not go first. And maybe we can't get into the 8A because we can't show profitability. Maybe we can't get into the SBIRS program. Where do we go for capital? Because, look, we're business people. We're not just going to wait around. Yeah. We've got this idea. What ends up happening if we can't actually engage and plug into the U.S. government acquisition system?
We're going to go somewhere else.
Where do we go?
We're going to cross the ocean.
Uh-huh.
It happens all the time. I mean, so I have a program that I've been associated with for 15 years. We started as an Army research program. It was an appropriation. We got an earmark. I'll use what you know, some people call it a dirty word, an earmark, for a program to do research on alternative processes to manufacture titanium from raw ore.
Oh, wow.
Right. So the process to make titanium metal is super nasty. One of those like super energy dependent, really bad chemicals, everything bad about a process.
Right.
And the Army needs titanium, right? The Air Force, the aviation world sucks up most of the world's titanium metal. Mm-hmm. You know, most airplanes we fly in or fly are titanium. So they're sucking up most of the demand, most of the metal. Everybody else needs it because it's half the weight of steel and twice the strength.
Oh, wow.
Wonder metal, right? But it's super expensive. So they say, hey, there's all these processes in the world. We were with the Research Command. Research Command says, we know that there's like 10, 12 processes that are being worked on. Can you guys take a look, do a research project, build a little lab, test some stuff out, and see if any of these are viable?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the beginning of groundbreaking technology, right? And it's something that, you know, you're not going to get a company to do, because it's super high risk tech.
Mm-hmm.
It's super expensive, you know, capital intensive.
Got to be heavily polluting too, right? I mean,
what's your end game, right? Your end game is that I'm going to try to make a new process. Well, you know how long that takes? Mm-hmm. That's 20 years, right?
Yeah.
I got to have money for 20 years to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So we come up with a program and we start it. We get an earmark. We get another one. And, you know, so the program is really, and we actually figure out, by chance, well, I don't say by chance, but, you know, we have really good people. We actually develop a new process out of this that we believe is going to be the answer. You know, we're working on this process. You know, we get two earmarks. We have a large earmark in the 2010 bill, defense bill. And if you remember, that's the one that Senator McCain stood on the floor and pulled all earmarks out of the bills.
I remember it.
Out of the bill.
Yes.
We lost, there was $12 or $15 million of funding in that bill for us, and we lost it. Mm-hmm. And it became virtually impossible for the next 4 or 5 years, I would say, to get any money into a defense bill for projects, right? Despite, didn't matter who you knew. I mean, it just, you couldn't get funding. So we were trying to go back to the Army, trying to go back to, we went to the Department of Interior, we went to, you name the agency, we were there talking about our process, and every one of them saying, really important, you know, every document that comes out say, this is strategic material, it's strategic to our national security, we must do something about it. And we could not get any money anywhere. So we had to raise money. We raised money from an individual here in the United States. Mm-hmm. And we had to cut deals with industrial. We had to find some industrial partners. So we went abroad.
Where'd you go abroad?
Japan.
Japan. Okay.
And now Canada.
And has that allowed the progress to continue?
Oh, yeah. Significantly increased progress to, you know, quantum level. I would say it sped us up years, you know, which we had lost years because of the money that we thought we were going to have from the U.S. government that we couldn't get.
Right. You know, when you hear about a capability like that, that's so exciting, yet that story just brings to the forefront the real challenges. And as you and I know, there are stories in the press right now where companies are going to China, or China is opening up shell companies, basically, and harvesting, vacuuming up our technologies. So it's not just a paperwork problem. It's not just I have to deal with the FAR and I have to wait. The problem is, of course, that some of these missions that desperately need modern and innovative technologies to keep pace and stay ahead, they're not getting it. Wow. So, wow, that is really interesting. And all right, so I want to step back, and I always get a little bit frustrated when we kick this stuff around.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about, just if we waved a magic wand, what are some things that we would absolutely do? But before we do that, I want to just go to one other area. You mentioned before that, hey, there's too many lawyers and there can be too much regulation. And a lot of people think of JEDI. And for those that don't know, this was a giant contract that was going to happen out of the Pentagon, worth $10 billion for cloud computing across Pentagon, DOD. And it went through years of litigation and eventually did not go through protests. So when we think about JEDI and we think about too many lawyers and protests, what really went on there, Mark, from your point of view?
I mean, I still think that was a politically motivated acquisition that, you know, I mean, that was, you know, two billionaires, you know, I guess I'll say pissing in the wind at each other, right? You know,
Jeff Bezos and Donald Trump.
I mean, the reality of where we should be, you know, the government should be able to buy the services that it needs, you know, in a much easier format than saying we're going to put a $10 billion contract out to one of them. Mm-hmm. Right. That's an insane concept. Why would they lock themselves in that way?
Mm-hmm. Well,
you know, because there is there are certain portions we've run across while we are, you know, my former company has had the first ATO authorization to operate on Amazon in for the Air Force, the very first one,
which is amazing.
So, you know, we're heavy, you know, we are absolutely 100% an Amazon shop, but that doesn't mean that Microsoft Azure doesn't have use and isn't useful for the government in certain instances. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they have other needs, right? They may need a private enclave in the cloud. That's totally different than all of
them. Right.
So I don't understand, like, the whole acquisition made no sense to me.
Yeah, I get that. And I think a few years ago, I was doing some research, and I believe that I read that 44% of acquisitions are protested. That's a lot of protests.
Yeah. Which is why you see a huge drive towards to IDIQs and task orders, because task orders under 10 million can't be protested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
So if you start moving, so you see the change in the, you know, I mean, everything's tied together, right? Mm-hmm. So when you start to tie together the amount of protests with the way they're doing acquisitions, you realize that a lot of what they're doing is just to avoid it, mm-hmm. right? So when they put out like these mega vehicles like the GSA ones, right? They're non-protest. It's pretty much non-protestable mm-hmm. because they're not rating on technical. There's no actual subjective rating. All it is a score sheet, right? Do you have this many what's your CPARS ratings? Can you provide us, 20 CPARS ratings of 3.5 plus?
And for those that don't know what CPARS are, Mark, sorry to interrupt, but CPARS are?
Yeah, so the Contractor Performance Assessment Rating System, I think yeah. that's the acronym. I mean, it's close to yeah. it, right? But, so every time you perform work for the government as a prime, you're getting a CPARS rating, mm-hmm. right? But most of the contractors don't understand how to influence those CPARS ratings even, mm-hmm. how to make sure that your customer understands that if they just put satisfactory for you, which just means you're doing a good job, that's not good enough, mm-hmm. right? You have to get very goods in excellence.
Yes.
If you don't, you don't have enough points to apply for most of these big contracts. Mm-hmm. And people don't even understand that there's a correlation. They see satisfactory, like, oh, we're doing a good job. I would love to be doing a very good job. What can I do for that?
Yeah, it's kind of like if you get a satisfactory when you're working for a company on your job yeah. performance report, that's probably not great.
It's probably not great.
Exactly. So there's
that piece plus, okay, so you have an ISO certificate. Mm-hmm. You have these three ISOs, you get this many points. So the whole contract is awarded based on points. It's non-protestable. Mm-hmm. What are you going to protest? They didn't subjectively do anything.
Yes.
So why are they doing it that way? Because it's not protested, because it can't be protested.
Yeah.
And once they get these things into these buckets, right, so they're making these little buckets of companies that can then go bid on work. And if they keep the work under certain levels, it can't be protested. Right. So it's a way to get around a whole lot of regulation.
Yeah. And for those listening, this notion of IDIQ, these are indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity contracts. And the thinking, I was a contract officer back in CIA back in 2000. And the thinking was, oh, this is going to be great because we were writing individual contracts and doing sure. so much repetitive work. So, let's just get this baseline in place where then we can just let task orders.
Which is great, and it makes a lot of sense.
But if you're not on that IDIQ, that's a problem.
You're out of luck.
All right, so back to the magic wand. If you could yeah. wave your magic wand and Mark Schneiderman's, hey, these are the top five things that we've got to change. What's the first thing? I mean, you are king for the day. What's the first thing you would change?
I mean, right now, it probably is the idea. It probably is... I would kill any of these large contracts that are awarded where there's no technical requirement. I think it's totally okay. unfair that people are getting contracts just based on their certifications and CPARs, which, if you know how to influence them, you can influence them.
Right.
Like to me, you should go back to having to write technical proposals, right? And be judged based on your technical understanding it should always be the number one factor for me.
And now there's no in getting all of those certifications and going through that process of getting on that IDIQ. There is some weighting of your technical prowess, is there not, in past performance?
Yeah, I mean, you could say that there's some because you had past performance in certain things, but you can bend them. If you know how to write, you can bend something that,
I gotcha.
Let's just say you can make something that's researched look like it's C4ISR in three sentences.
Yeah.
Right.
And C4ISR,
it's not hard.
command control, intelligence, surveillance, yeah. reconnaissance, computing, all that good stuff. How do you get at though, Mark? And I love the boldness of killing the IDIQ. How do you get at when I was a junior contract officer back when I was a young man, and I had 56 different contracts in some form of maturity on my desk versus IDIQs, because we were excited that IDIQs were coming online back then.
Oh yeah.
How do you deal with that problem?
I think use of IDIQ isn't necessarily bad.
Okay.
I think it's when we consolidate too much into one IDIQ.
Okay.
If they're being used for a repetitive acquisition that, you need 5 years of contracts, mm-hmm. you know, and you want to lock up 5 years, but you don't want, you can't put up 5 years of money and you can't commit to 5 years with the contractor, but you can commit to, here's an umbrella for what the next 5 years looks like. And we're going to give you a task order every year. Mm-hmm. I think that is great contracting.
Yeah.
I think it's excellent. And I think it works very well. The problem is the multi-award ones where they do it specifically to avoid competition.
Yeah. So that's, of course, the opposite of fair, open competition.
Yeah.
In your view, once, let's say, for GSA, OASIS, some of these massive contract vehicles, there are a limited number. I don't remember the off the top of my head. And there's OASIS small, and then there's for the large.
Yeah.
But it's certainly not in the thousands, right? And when you think about back to our entrepreneurs, they're out there by the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, and they have no way of getting on those contracts because of the way they're structured. It's structured that if you're – I mean, I know companies that are very good size companies that can't get on OASIS.
Right.
That have ISO certification, but they just – if you've subbed too much, right, if you've been a sub on too many contracts and you can't get enough prime work, which is a huge problem for most small, mid-sized businesses – like the mid-tier in particular, right? Mm-hmm. The mid-tier gets squeezed all the time, right? And the mid-tier, from my definition, everybody's definition is kind of a little different. Mm-hmm. I say anybody less than 150 to 200 million. If you're in that 50 to 200 million range where you're no longer a small, mm-hmm. but you're not up into the next tier, that tier of contractors, and there's a lot of them, right? I mean, I think the last I had heard is probably around 1,200 registered government contractors in that tier.
Yeah.
They can't bid as smalls. They can't really compete with the tier ones and tier twos. I mean, because they just don't have the capability, mm-hmm. right? Maybe they have 300, 500 employees. They don't have 10,000 employees. Mm-hmm. They can't say they can do every single thing that ever existed in the history of time. Which, find something that Lockheed can't say they can do.
Yeah, right.
In the GovCom world, there isn't anything.
That's right.
There can't be anything where they don't have past performance in it.
That's right. Outside of perhaps being incredibly nimble, agile, and fast on a daily basis. But I get your point. It's almost like if you were looking at the history of the Bible, the Old Testament and the New Testament, that's Lockheed Martin in defense, right? They've got all of the books. They've got all of the chapters.
They wrote the book. So, and you're a mid-tier trying to compete with them, and, you're going up against the BAEs, the Booz Allens, for work, that they can, and they have, and when contracting is down, luckily contracting has been up for the past few mm-hmm. years. So they're not dipping down into some of the lower tier work that they wouldn't normally go after mm-hmm. as much. But if you go back 10 years when, dollars were a little down, they were dipping down and they're coming after work that you're looking at them like, I can't believe they're competing for this. Mm-hmm. And they'll crush you.
Mm-hmm. So if you're a mid-tier,
they have those companies have 100 rate tier structures, right?
Yeah.
If people don't understand rate tiers, I mean, your G&A and your overhead structure, most small companies and mid-sized companies, if you have an on-site and an off-site rate, that's probably about all you have, mm-hmm. right? These companies have, 75, 100 different structures that they'll use to bid aggressively and go after work.
And absolutely. And what a lot of folks don't understand is if you're a government contractor with that wrap rate, with that overhead structure, the government is paying for your research and development. They're paying when you sell back to the government, bid and proposal. The government's paying for all of it. So it's incredibly low risk. And I want to dig on that a little bit. I get that if you're that mid-tier contractor, that 50 to 200 million, you've graduated from 8A, you don't have some of those, let's say, special sort of regulations that allow you to compete anymore. And now you're stuck trying to compete. You've got all of these bigs on these different IDIQs, and you're wrestling with all of that. That's incredibly tough. Yet it seems from a risk point of view, Mark, that you talked about who is the real customer before, and nobody wants to be responsible. Let's say we kill IDIQs or we change them, because you're not for getting rid of the idea completely, but you're saying, wait a second, we can't just park everything there. Let's say we change them and you're that contracting officer for the Air Force that was part of it and it goes wrong. From a risk point of view, your career is in serious jeopardy. So it seems that risk is one of the biggest things outside of the fair and open. Risk of screwing up is another area that really bites us. What do you think about that?
Yeah, which is why I think the proposal and the technical, you know, write-up is what matters the most, right? They should be able, the company should be able to prove to you that they aren't, that they are low risk and that they are the best value and the best option for the government. And when you take that, I mean, they're doing it on a task order by task order basis right now. But even then, you've already made, the determination's already been made that these companies are the ones that are allowed to come in. Right. So you've locked out a certain set of companies that can't even get into the game.
That's right.
That may have had the best solution, may be the most technically advanced and probably have the lowest risk to the government because they've done it. They know what to do.
Right. OK, so we got to reform the IDIQ places of what we're doing there. What
I would love to go back to as a number two for me, because, you know, it's kind of near and, you know, I would say, you know, the earmark concept isn't the worst thing that's ever happened in the world, and we should go back to using them. And I'll use the, you know, so my titanium project, I mean, part of this is there's some selfishness here.
Right.
Right. In terms of, you know, this was historically how I had a program that was built, and we saw earmarks go away and it hurt significantly. But there are very, you know, and so now we've seen a new way to get appropriations through right now. Nobody calls it earmarks anymore. They call them appropriations, right? They're line item appropriations where you have to find a sponsor at an agency so say you go to, you know, the Army Research Lab and you find a sponsor there that was interested in the program that you want to run, and you get them to accept the money onto their line item. Right. So you have a program element line item in the budget. You get your senator and your congressman to send money to it. But there's nothing really describing that it's you or it's your company and that's where it's supposed to go to. So if you don't really know the system, that money disappears into the ether.
Ah, so that's it.
And it happens all the time. It happened to us. Like, we had it happen. And I know lots of companies that have had it happen.
Right. Now, when you say bring back earmarks, that's controversial because so many I grew up in Pennsylvania and
the Murthaville.
Jack Murtha. And Jack was
the house that Murtha built.
Yes. And bringing home the pork, and people wonder, well, why are there defense contractors up in Johnstown, Pennsylvania? Why are there drug enforcement agencies up there? Why are there industrial Jack Murtha? And it goes on and on.
I mean, there's going to have to be some rules and regulations around it. Right. And evaluation. But, you know, they've done one of the things that they've been forced to do is get more, you know, creative and evaluate projects a little harder than they used to in the new process because it's so hard for them to get them through. So you don't really change a lot of what is currently there now in Congress and how you get these things in. You just make sure that they can actually be directed in a better way.
Right.
So the biggest difference to me was when an earmark would say, you know, your company's name and the project. So you could identify it in the bill and, you know, it wasn't going to get swiped, let's say.
Right. Whereas if you have a line item in this giant appropriation bill, good luck.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they need money. Every agency needs money. Every agency, they're not doing anything wrong or nefarious. It's just there's funding and nobody's attached to it. We're going to use it.
Okay, I get that. And that makes sense. And we're not just saying bring back earmarks so that.
No, not unfettered in the way that they were at one point, which was just there was craziness at one point.
That's right.
You know, I mean, of course, you know, the funny thing is McCain pulled him out because he lost the because he had lost an earmark project of his own.
So his motive was somewhat personal as well as perhaps.
Yeah, his motive was personal.
Yeah, interesting.
It was funny because you mentioned hypersonic earlier, and it was a hypersonic wind tunnel project that was the cause of all of it.
Interesting. I didn't know that part of it. I knew that he was mad and I knew he was a champion of it.
Yeah.
Okay. So right now we're saying that we're going to really go after how we do IDIQs and reform that.
Yeah.
We're going to say we're going to bring back earmarks in some cases so that when money gets set aside, let's say for that titanium company.
Yeah, for those innovative technologies that we need to be that are too high risk for companies to take on and they need government sponsorship. And there are a significant number of projects like that in the world right now. You know, that You know, I mean, I guess the you know, it's akin to titanium, but you know, you'll always hear rare earths, so like the big talk, and you'll keep hearing about rare earths for the next 5 or 10 years because we haven't done anything. This conversation started 15 to 20 years ago when they realized that, oh my goodness, all the rare earths, which are basically, you know, every magnet or GPS or anything in a computer or your phone, uh-huh. right? Every piece of technology that we have has a rare earth magnet in it.
Yeah.
Now, I think the last count was 92% of the world's rare earths are manufactured in China.
Yeah, and I read all the time how whether it's deep sea or in Antarctica or anything, they are moving out in serious ways. We just passed a bill through Congress 6 months ago, and we're deciding to move, and we were celebrating ourselves, and I thought, I'm not sure that we should be getting too excited. We're just starting to get into the game. And you make
sense. Yeah, I mean, we're so far from, you know, what it's going to take to, you know, they keep saying, oh, we'll just find, we have reserves, we have, you know, a mine, we can pull it out of the mine. We don't know how to do anything with it. Mm-hmm. There's no technology here to actually extract it.
Yeah. And when you think about it, if you want to get to the crux, serious world powers are after energy and anything that they can use to fuel and then manufacture, again, those rare earth, all kinds of different, whether you're talking about cobalt or platinums and titaniums and all of this different stuff, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got two. What's your number three in the Snyderman top five?
I'd say the IDIQ one also goes to the way in which we're allowing these contracts to be let, you know, in terms of if it's an idea, if we are going to have larger IDIQs, and I'm not saying we shouldn't have any, mm-hmm. right? Because you do need them. They're needed in, there are certainly needs for, you know, having some vehicles for larger acquisitions. Mm-hmm. They can't be based on subjective numbers. There still has, on objective numbers only, there needs to be a subjective tech piece. I don't see that we should be letting contracts out that are numbers only. Because I personally know companies that got locked out of Oasis and some of these other GSA vehicles that they should all be on, and it was purely a numbers game, and they deserve to have a seat on those contracts.
So when you say a subjective tech piece, what do you mean by that, Mark? Do you mean that a company should be able to do a demonstration where maybe they don't have
not even demonstration, write a real technical approach and understanding, you know, give them sample task orders to write to,
okay,
and rate them,
okay.
You know, if the thing is so big, right? The argument is that these contracts that are coming out cover everything from, you know, a desktop help person to a cloud engineer to a, you know, a cybersecurity, you know, top level professional, mm-hmm. right? So they said, well, you can't write to everything, right? You can't. How am I going to write a technical approach? Well, they used to use sample task orders, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you probably used them back when you were a contracting officer.
Yes.
Right. If the scope is so big, well, hey, what would you say if I gave you this task order? Can you write to it?
Yeah, I get it.
And if you can't write to it, you don't deserve the contract.
I get it. So back to your Lockheed example. Oh, I can get on GSA Alliant or GSA Oasis and I can show you all kinds of certifications and past performance. And you're saying that's great. But here's my problem. It's a new problem. Can you write to that? Can you show me forward looking what you could do, which is really interesting thought on that. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So I like it. So number three is, hey, wait a second. You got to really be able to prove. I'm not just relying on what you did in the past. Actually show me the power of your solution.
Yeah.
Okay. I like it. And, you know, I want to talk about one more thing on that. So much when we've talked to people over the years, in government, we get to requirements. There are things that government may not be capable to write those requirements. From your point of view, would it be better to actually say, here's what we're wrestling with, kind of a problem-based, and then people, back to your point,
provide us some solutions.
Yeah, yeah. Instead of issuing, here's the mil spec, here's the requirements, go do these things, focus on that, work from the problem point of view.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's great. Yeah, I think that's a great point.
Okay, number four.
I'll go back to the 8A program, and I want to fix that one.
Okay,
I don't think you should have to throw 2 years of positive of you know net income, right? Positive net income doesn't necessarily mean anything if you're running the, you know, as you know, as an entrepreneur, you know, it's not always in your favor to show positive net income to pay, you know, for you, you may have tax driven reasons why you're not doing, while you're not showing.
Absolutely.
Anything. And you may want to get, you may want to spend some money in your business, which you need to be doing early on in particular.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I think it's, I think, you know, showing that a company is, you know, I'm at a loss for words right now, which isn't normal for me. You know, it's financially solvent is different than showing than profitability. Right?
Ah, so interesting. So instead of proving that, hey, for 2 years, you're just a dynamo, focus more on solvency with 8 A's.
Yeah.
Solvencies. Yeah. And what about when we were talking about technical capability before?
Yeah.
Give them a chance to make that
part of the program is that, you know, can they actually manage work, mm-hmm. you know, and so figure out, like, ask the questions to make sure that they know what they're going to be able to handle the work when it comes. Mm-hmm. You can't make it too technical because the big thing about the ADA program, there's a whole lot of problems around the program itself, right? Because it's incentivized that a lot of the work isn't the highest level work that's going 8A, mm-hmm. right? It's a lot of times it's lower level functions within the base.
Right.
Right. So that's not fair in and of itself, but.
Yeah. So under reforming 8A, I get it. We'll focus on the solvency piece first, but then perhaps really thinking about where could these firms be plugged in to do amazing work? Instead of just saying, okay, yeah, you're going to get some basic services stuff. We're going to allow you to do some logistical stuff.
We're going to have you snow plowing and landscaping. Okay, great.
Yeah, and hey, needed service, but that's not necessarily titanium and, you know, going to prepare us for
high-end computing or, you know, cluster computing work, quantum technologies. Like, they do this stuff.
Yes.
Some of these companies are some of the most advanced companies we have, and we're not taking, you know, we're giving them low level work because that's how they're going to eat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear that. Okay. So we've got four tangible things.
Yeah.
What's number
five? The fifth one, I think it's a little less tangible at this point in my mind, but there is something that, you know, in the compliance world that, you know, if you look at it from as a lawyer, right? So where my compliance at as a lawyer and advising clients, there's a significant issue when I have to sit with a small business that's, you know, got 10 employees or 20 employees, and they have the same exact compliance requirements as, let's pick on Lockheed again because we've been picking on them the whole time, as Lockheed Martin.
Right.
That's a significant issue.
Sure it is.
Like finding some way to make things, you know, more fair in that world, right? Where, you know, they may not, there are rules that every company must follow and is obligated to follow. Mm-hmm. But there has to be some ways to mitigate the requirements on some of these smaller companies.
Well, you know,
CMMC, I think, is probably the big one that's going to hit everybody right now. Mm-hmm. You know, so if CMMC is the, I don't even know what it stands for. It's the cybersecurity maturity model. Something,
yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So DFARS has been the, you know, everybody calls it the DFARS rule, which is the current rule that exists for your cybersecurity posture for your company. Mm-hmm. And it has no teeth, right? Which is a problem, right? So you're basically saying people just have to say, yeah, I have a plan in place and I'm doing things. And, you know, we all know that's not sufficient. We've had significant issues with the Chinese, the Russians, the North Koreans, you know, there's hackers attacking networks all day. If you're holding, you know, some of this kind of, you know, unclassified but controlled information on your network, which anybody that's doing government contracting is probably holding, mm-hmm. how do you make sure that they're doing the right thing from a cybersecurity posture?
Right.
Well, stick some teeth into a regulation, right? But the regulation that's proposed, I mean, CMMC has now been, I lost track of when it started, probably about 2 or 3 years ago, that it came out that this was going to happen. And here we are. And, you know, they're saying March, there should be regulations out. I don't know. you have a real problem where you're telling these companies that they're going to have to spend $50,000 to $100,000 on a cybersecurity plan.
You know, and it's such an interesting, good point. So much of my time working with contractors, I have seen almost knockdown, drag out fights on compliance. Because you have, in writing the proposal, in preparing for the orals presentation, people want to come up with creative, that's not going to be compliant. And I get that some level of compliance is key. Yeah. But again, when you're talking about, if you're the government and maybe you have a information technology problems, you need to improve your cyber, you want to do artificial intelligence, you want to move more towards automation, you are not the expert in those things. So already telling folks here, you must be, in order to be compliant within your tech prop, it's this huge dilemma. And then myself and people look to me and they say, well, Eric, okay, great. You're our orals coach. Help us out. And I'm going, wow, let's really get the surfboard out and try to balance. But it's frustrating because a lot of times you're working with brilliant people and they have incredible ideas. And to your point, you start to take the teeth out of them. Well, the government didn't ask for that. Ooh, that may not be compliant. That's going to, it's frustrating. So I think it's one of those issues that really deserves serious review, right? When we talk about, okay, what are some bare minimum standards for compliance? But it can't just rule the day. And it goes back to risk that we were talking about before. It becomes very easy on the other side to take a low risk approach and just say, okay, well, you weren't compliant, you're out. All right. So I like that's a top five list of things that absolutely I think you've made the case that need to be worked on. Mm-hmm. In wind down, Mark, a couple of thoughts from a legal reform point of view. I mean, neither you and I, we're not kings, but if you were king for the day, 44% protest rate. How would you change that? I mean, everything seems to end back at GAO and it's litigated. What would you do to change that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, it really comes down to, you know, transparency in the process is supposed to be there, right? Mm-hmm. If you had more, if it really was as transparent as the process is supposed to be, and arguably, you know, like they set it out to be, you probably wouldn't have as many protests, right?
Yeah.
Because you'd know better where you stood. You know, you'd know better why the decisions are made, and, you know, you're not going to fight it as hard. You know, I don't know. I mean, it's really hard because I grew up as a small business, right? You know, we didn't protest anything. Mm-hmm. Protest is a bad word.
You're afraid to do that. You don't want to be marked.
I'm afraid I'm going to ruin my that contracting officer is going to know that I'm the guy that, you know, protests everything. They're not going to want to award anything to me or deal with me. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah. And you know, the transparency from the market survey in the beginning, right now, a lot of times contract officers and contract officer reps and program managers, they have no idea. We don't really have a database that represents across the United States and across the world. Here are some of the things that are going on. And we really struggle if we were looking at from a notion of innovation and, you know, global challenges and problem statements. We're not really doing a lot of that as well. So it seems to me there could be a lot of progress that could be made there to reform some of those challenges.
I think that would be the easy, you know, I don't say it's easy, but it's definitely the path that I would take to try to kill off some of what goes on. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure exactly. I don't think I've really thought through enough on the legal side. Like, how do you change that? Because there's so much of it is just the attitude and the aggressive behavior of, well, hey, you just fight it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that to me is just, like I said, you know, I never had that. My company never had it. They still don't have it. It's not in their ethos. Right. So there's an ethos which is way bigger than the GovCon industry in the United States of litigiousness.
Yeah.
Right. That you just fight everything. And, you know, I mean, maybe it's because, you know, we fought for our freedom and we've been fighting for this country for 200 some years and it's just in our nature. But, you know, I like to think that, you know, I've always been one of those attorneys that said, if I'm ever in court, then I did something really wrong.
Yeah.
I should never, my company should never see a courtroom.
You know,
never.
It's interesting. Very few attorneys are going to be as candid as you're being to say, hey, we have too many lawyers, too many regulations, yeah. too much bureaucracy. And certainly there's a place for lawyers and brilliant lawyers and what they do. But I get it. And if you think about it, even if you go beyond GovCon, it seems like across the United States, no matter what you want to do right now, we're getting more and more bureaucratic, more and more,
yeah.
and we're pushing. Okay, well, it's ultimately up to the Supreme Court oftentimes. Okay, so my last question would be, Mark, you've been in this GovCon space for a long time. What keeps you positive and what keeps you still plugging away and either offering legal services or still working on the entrepreneurial side? What yeah. keeps you in the game?
I would say, you know, because the, you know, a lot of my work has been DOD side. And, you know, we have soldiers, whether you believe in whatever, we're not the ones that are putting these soldiers in harm's way, mm-hmm. but they're getting put there.
Yes.
And, you know, providing them the best capability to do their job and provide them the best opportunity to come home safe. Mm-hmm. There's your driving factor right there. It always has been and always will be for me. You know, none of us are the ones that are making that decision that they're there, but they're there and they need to have the best tools and we should be the best in the world. We should have the best tools.
I totally agree. Even your dog agrees with us and your dog was wagging.
Yeah, sorry about
that. That's all good. And I think about it too. So often it becomes easy in GovCon to get inside baseball. And yet, if you step back a little bit, you say, whoa, these challenges have real consequence. And, yeah. and especially now, you know, in America, folks, you know, our age, we've become used to this American dominance and national security and capabilities. But those days are over. And it's not to say the missions and the patriots that serve them, they're doing incredible things. But if you're trying to make the case right now that we're wildly ahead of China, in some areas mm-hmm. still, yes, super fighters, maybe yes, artificial intelligence, no, right? So these right. are incredibly important topics that, yeah, the mission does matter. And I'm glad you're still staying with it. And that's where I'm at too. There are parts yeah. about GovCon that drive me nuts, but it's where I'm going to
stay. It makes you want to bang your head against the wall.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's where I'm going to stay.
It's like GovCon's like programming, right? You're banging your head against the wall most days, mm-hmm. trying to figure out why did they do that and how do I fix that and how can I make this happen? Because, you know, I'm a small cog in a really, really big wheel. But, you know, you do your part and you try to keep, you know, supporting the missions and help. And for me right now, it's helping, you know, the companies that I see that have some great solutions and doing great work and helping them, you know, navigate. And, you know, I say I'm lucky because I have 20, 30 years of experience in this and I've seen a whole lot of different pieces of it. And, you know, my legal background certainly gives me a different perspective on it. And I'd say, you know, I can help a lot of companies because of that. It gives me, you know, sort of I just have a different little look at it because my perspective is a little different.
I hear that. And I appreciate you coming on, Mark, and really sharing just candid thoughts, showing the thought leadership. And just talking about, man, some ways that we can make this process better, right? Some tangible ways that we can do it as well. Yeah, I get people want to say, oh, well, good luck getting this through Congress. Yeah, well, we got to start with the ideas first. And if people can start to understand more of the process and what we're really talking about regarding mission, so key. Well, Mark, I appreciate you coming on, man. I look forward to talking with you again. And I look forward to staying in touch with you and kind of tracking your progress in a lot of the companies that you're working on.
Yeah, you as well. I appreciate you having me on. Thanks a lot. It was a lot of fun.
GovCon Different. Ideas from the outside applied to GovCon to drive change.
It's like TED Talks meets the federal space.
Different ideas from different industries, uncovered, unvarnished, and smashed together to produce change in the government space. Join us as we explore a world of GovCon possibilities.